Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again for another episode of Alternating Current, where we take a dive into technology and innovation. In this episode, we're going to discuss the current state of U.S. innovation policy. I'm very lucky to discuss this topic with a true expert in Adam Mossoff. Adam Mossoff is professor of law at Antonin Scalia Law School, George Mason University. He teaches a wide range of courses at the law school, including property, patent law, trade secrets, trademark law, remedies, and internet law. His research primarily focuses on the theoretical justification for and historical protection of patents and other intellectual property rights as private property rights secured to inventors and creators, and thus function as commercial assets in driving a growing innovation economy and flourishing society. Professor Mossoff's writings on intellectual property policy have appeared in the popular The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Forbes, The Hill, Politico, and in other media outlets. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, where he is also chair of the Forum for Intellectual Property, and he is a visiting intellectual property fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for joining Alternating Current, Adam.
Thank you, Tyson. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how is where are we at with our innovation policy? Are we winning? Are we making it great again? Or how is our patent policy today?
It's a very good question. And it's a question that often is not discussed publicly very much beyond specialists. And it ought to be and should be because it impacts everyone's lives. All of the things that we use today, from our toothbrushes to our coffee machines to our refrigerators, were made possible by a legal system that not only incentivized innovators to come up with those inventions, which all of those things were inventions, but then made it possible through property rights systems, through patents and copyrights and trademarks, to deploy these products and services into the market, take these inventions in the lab and in people's garages, and turn them into real-world products that benefit the lives of consumers. This has been a key feature, something that was really unique to the United States historically. We were the first country that took the position that these should be property rights, on par with the property rights that a farmer has in one's crops that one labors on to produce over the span of a year. The byproducts of inventive labors and creative labor should be secured to innovators and creators, and that this is what drives an innovation economy. And it drove with the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century in this country. It drove the computer revolution in the 20th century, and it is now driving the biotech and mobile revolution today. And this is, of course, the point of comparison, our baseline for then evaluating what's happening today. And what's happening today is we've turned our back on this. In the past 10 or 15 years, in particular, the patent system in this country has been put under a tremendous amount of strain from all branches of government, from the courts, and in particular the U.S. Supreme Court, from Congress, and from regulatory agencies that have been chipping away at, and in some cases outright eliminating, the very rights that have driven the creation of all of these innovations. And again, just to kind of make this real and concrete, right, we're talking about classic innovators, whether historically like Samuel Morse's invention of the telegraph, or Isaac Singer's contribution to creating the sewing machine, Thomas Edison, his light bulb and direct current electrical systems and the phonograph, the Wright brothers' airplane, and so on and so on, Alexander Graham Bell's telephone, to up through today, to our laptop computers, our incredible smartphones, and the very drugs and diagnostic tests that we are taking, especially that are important today given the COVID-19 pandemic. And so the courts and the Congress and the regulatory agencies have been chipping away and eliminating these rights in this country, to the point that we no longer have the gold standard patent system as compared to the rest of the world. And this is important because we won't see tomorrow an elimination of new innovative technologies and products and services that make modern life a veritable miracle by historical standards, but it will impact over the long run. So what's going to happen is 5, 10, 15 years, if we don't change course, you're going to see fewer new drugs, fewer new technological innovations, fewer new products and services being brought to the market, because startups and innovators and other great entrepreneurs won't have the legal framework of the protection of their innovations and creative works that they can then take into the market and produce products and services for consumers.
And you kind of hit on some very important points there, especially with regards to where the current U.S. innovation policy is going. I look back over the past decade and the Supreme Court cases of Mayo, Myriad, and Alice, and look at those. And those are all Supreme Court cases for our listeners that have actually, I would say, a very strong argument that has weakened our standing in the biotech area, and also with regards to computer implemented inventions, potentially neural network, artificial intelligence, diagnostic testing. What has that all stemmed from? You know, do the Supreme Court justices just not have a good idea, or potentially maybe that this is not in their area of expertise, and so they're handing down judgments on very important technology areas and maybe not having the best expertise within this area?
Well, that's a great question. You know, and this is kind of a Gordian knot that specialists in innovation and people who are concerned about innovation policy and patent law policy in this country have been trying to cut for the past decade or so. There are a lot of different factors at play. One common theme that one hears from patent lawyers and specialists is, of course, well, the Supreme Court justices don't understand the complex technologies. They don't understand this complex area of law. But, you know, we have to be careful about that claim, because that's true of every area of law. Every area of law is very specialized, you know, complex telecommunications law, outside of patent law, you know, complex commercial disputes, and that involve very, very complicated, supply chain innovations and things of the sort that don't entail patents, right? The Supreme Court they're not experts in these issues. They're not experts in how bankruptcy has been developed or deployed over the years, so on and so on. In fact, one often hears from lawyers who specialize in other areas the exact same complaint. Supreme Court doesn't understand our area of law. This is what's causing them to misunderstand it. And of course, that could be a factor in it. But you know, there's a virtue and a value to having generalist courts. We've always had generalist courts for most of this country's history, and still do in most areas of law. because a lot of the issues that drive patent law are not dependent upon the technology per se. They reflect general policies that are shared throughout all areas of law, including even regular property law, concerns about securing to people the fruits of their productive labors, concerns about certainty and defining with precision the boundaries of people's rights such that they know what their rights and duties are vis-a-vis other people's rights and duties, and so on and so on. So some of it comes down to, I think, yes, you know, the Supreme Court doesn't understand some of the complexities of U.S. patent law, but also, you know, what the Supreme Court has repeatedly shown in many of its decisions, of course, is that they have come to embrace this view of patents as monopoly grants, which brings an entire different context for evaluating a legal entitlement if it's defined as a monopoly grant, as opposed to being defined as a property right. And this approach cuts across what are typically ideological divisions on the U.S. Supreme Court. So Justice Breyer, on the one hand, and Justice Thomas, on the other, both have come to firmly embrace this view of patents as monopolies that impede and undermine innovation, and also are specialized, you know, grants, as monopoly grants are, from the government, and thus what the government giveth, the government can take it away, and applying longstanding kind of legal norms for how you interpret them. Monopoly grants historically are construed very narrowly against the grantee in favor of the public because it's a monopoly grant, and so on and so on, which is actually in contradistinction to what the general approach of the U.S. has been for much of its history, which is that these are actual property rights, as I mentioned earlier, on par and similar to property rights in other types of assets like farms and commercial businesses and factories. In fact, these were analogies that 19th century judges often made when deciding patent cases, and in fact, they cited to and relied upon kind of classic common law cases involving property rights in farms and land and other assets as precedent for deciding how they should define and secure the property rights in inventions. So, um, So some of it is kind of, you know, kind of foundational ideological, so to speak, and, you know, how you view a patent is whether it's a monopoly grant or a property right. Some of it is just kind of a misunderstanding of the complex technologies in the biotech space with, you know, molecular design drugs, you know, and tests that are rooted in, you know, the foundational cutting edge issues that we've now been made possible through this kind of combination of the high tech revolution and biomedical research that we now go identify by the term biotech, that, you know, makes it possible to, you know, do things that were once thought of as pure science fiction. I mean, 30 years ago, to say, you know, it would have been impossible to say we would have had treatments for viruses, which have been a scourge of, you know, humanity for tens of thousands of years. And yet we now have actual treatments for viruses that are made possible by these innovations. And of course, so the technology is complex, but you know, it, at the end of the day, you know, what you're trying to secure are the kind of the new, you know, values in the real world, technologies broadly defined, whether these are, you know, processes of how you detect a disease or the actual product, the molecule that is, that is directed to a particular disease, or a component of a smartphone or a component of an automobile or your Keurig coffee machine and so on and so on, that these are innovations. These are creations of human intelligence, of human creativity, of human innovative work, and therefore they should be secured to people and have been secured to people under our patent system for a long time. And as you mentioned, the Supreme Court in a series of decisions about starting 10 years ago now, is starting to withdraw the patent system, saying no, patents are not going to be protect, you know, cutting edge discoveries in, you know, the biotech space, in the ways in which we can detect and identify people's, you know, disease conditions and disease states. You know, patents are not going to be granted to secure the new creations in the high tech space. And this is really, really serious because they've withdrawn the patent system from the cutting edge area of our innovation economy. What's driving our economic growth? What's driving job creation? What's creating a flourishing society? You know, it's high tech and biotech. And, you know, this is a change from our historical practices. And this will have serious implications going forward.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm actually reading a book now entitled Pharma, and it goes through the history of pharma. And one of the big things, of course, is patent protection regarding, and then also the discovery of penicillin. We had also all of these other, so in the early 1900s, early to mid 1900s, we had all these discoveries that have, you know, where we were about a couple of years ago or 10 years ago with viruses, we were with regards to again, penicillin and a couple and other drugs that had been discovered at that time. And of course, what we'd found out from that, or what the book has, you know, pointed out, is that patent protection was a very important piece for all the companies that were developing these or continuing to bring these bear to fruit. And, you know, so it is important to have these patent rights and so forth. And additionally, the 1952 Patent Act was something that, of course, was the big change in patent law before the American Invents Act back in 2011. But we saw back in 1952 that the patent law had changed and been updated in regards to and relation to some of the things that were going on in the pharma industry.
Yes, I mean, the connection of, you know, the rise of the biopharmaceutical industry in the United States in the 1920s, and we really should be explicit about this, you know, most biopharmaceutical innovation has, you know, arose from the United States and was secured by patents in the United States. And so, as you mentioned, you know, that it was, the patent system was essential to the, you know, to, you know, protecting the fruits of these kind of innovative labors that scientists and others were engaging in to come up with incredible treatments and cures, all the way up through today, where we are now have treatments for and cures for for conditions that were death sentences, you know, in cancer, just, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And then conditions that, you know, were debilitating or death sentences that turned those conditions into just manageable life conditions, right? Hepatitis and diabetes and things of that sort. And it makes sense if you understand the economics of this, right? So Tufts University economists there did a very important study a few years ago and found that the average amount of R&D expenditure that is sunk cost behind a single medical treatment that makes it to market is approximately $2.6 billion. And that is because not that particular drug costs $2.6 billion, although it does cost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, but that for every single drug that makes it to market or medical treatment that makes it to market, there is approximately initially a 10,000 different molecules or potential treatment avenues, therapeutic treatments that scientists and researchers initially researched. And so you have this incredible funnel that occurs over the span of approximately 10 to 15 years where researchers are engaging in an ongoing process of trying to figure out, okay, we've discovered a molecule that might be active against a particular disease condition. And, you know, what scientists call, you know, an antigen, something that invades the body. And like the coronavirus. And so now how do we actually deliver this into the body? How do we get it past the hydrochloric acid in the human stomach? And how do we get it absorbed through the intestine? And how do we make sure that the body's own defenses, its antibodies, don't attack the medicine while it's trying to be delivered to the antigen? There's an incredible amount of innovation. This is what goes into years and years, tens of thousands of labor hours and billions of dollars of investment. And there's many, 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 many failures, as I indicated already. And so no one would make those investments if you didn't ultimately at the end of the day have some legal system saying you have a property right in the fruits of your creative labors. You can take that property right out into the market, into the world, and profit from those labors. To not just recoup your expenses you've already spent, but to fund your life and to benefit yourself and to fund ongoing work. You know, I mentioned already in the 19th century, you know, courts often made analogies to farmers, and that wasn't a rhetorical move. If you think of what farmers do, what property rights do for farmers is the exact same thing, right? If you think of a farmer in the 19th century, they spent a year of their life, you know, tilling the soil, fertilizing it, planting the seeds, husbanding the crops, weeding, preventing the destruction from insects and other pests, then finally harvesting the crops, right? They invest all of this time. That's sunk cost, sunk time, lost time. What farmer would spend a year of their life doing that if they weren't promised property rights and the fruits of their productive labors? And the same principle was extended to and recognized that in innovative labors as well, because even what the farmer does is rooted in inventions and technologies, whether it's the tractor or the scythe, or even the methods of how you plant and husband crops and the pesticides that kill insects and things of that sort. These things all had to be invented. So even innovations underlie what makes even basic farming possible.
Yeah, and you hit on basically a very important point that traditionally, up until a couple of years ago, patents were looked at as property rights. You know, you had your bundle of sticks. That was what the property rights represented. And patents were looked at that. Now it's looked at as a limited monopoly, right, based upon a recent Supreme Court decision that came down just a few years ago in relation to the American Invents Act. What does U.S., assuming that the trajectory of U.S. innovation policy is downward, what should the U.S. be looking at to improve?
Oh, it's a great question. Because we live in a global economy now. The question is always a comparative question. So, you know, so we are undermining and eliminating the kind of the reliable and effective property rights and patents that have driven our innovation economy for 200 years. You know, someone could legitimately say, okay, so why should I care about that? Well, that's because other countries are paying attention. And other countries are trying to position themselves vis-a-vis the United States to become innovation economies themselves. In particular, China is doing this. China, you know, is trying right now to become its own innovation economy. It's recognized that it can't stay a manufacturing economy and continue to grow its economy and create a more flourishing society for itself on the basis of manufacturing other people's innovative works. It has to kind of spur its own people to become innovative. And China recognized that one of the key features in the United States that drove its innovation economy for a very long time was our patent system. And so China is actually implementing many features of the U.S. patent system that we have since forsaken. So in China, you can get patents on cutting-edge biotech innovations and high-tech inventions that you no longer can get patents on in the United States. In fact, I published a study a few years ago showing that under the Supreme Court decisions that you had mentioned earlier, Mayo and Myriad, these are decisions that concern the eligibility of inventions for patent protection. It's known as patent eligibility doctrine. That we identified, 1,600 patent applications for the same inventions where the patents had been granted either in Europe, China, or both, but the patents for the exact applications covering for the exact same inventions have been rejected in the United States. And these were patent applications on cutting edge medical treatments and technological innovations. And so you can get patents in China now. China actually provides for classic property right protections, for their patent owners. So if someone's infringing your patent, historically you could have received an injunction, just like any property owner. Someone's coming into your home, you can get an injunction to stop a squatter from invading your home or trespassing across your property line. Used to be true in the United States. You could do the same thing as a patent owner with a property right in your invention. You could stop someone from using your invention without your authorization. But the Supreme Court eliminated that in 2006 in a decision known as eBay. And so on. And China is therefore implementing the very legal infrastructure that has accounted for the success of the U.S. Innovation economy itself. And it's implementing that at a time that we are actually withdrawing that innovation, that legal infrastructure that underlies your innovation economy. And innovators and investors are paying attention to that. And there's lots of studies that are showing that venture capital is drying up in the United States, in the areas of the economy that depend upon patent protection, like biotech and biopharmaceutical inventions and high-tech innovations, and is flowing overseas and it's going to places like China. There's more and more articles being written about how clinical trials and pharmaceutical innovations are being tested in China now, as opposed to the United States, because you can have the patent protections there that you cannot receive in the United States. Now, you might want to say, yeah, but they're still going to sell those products in the United States, so what's the big deal? Well, but where the property right protection is the locus of the economic activity. So if they get the patent protection in China and not in the United States, yes, so U.S. consumers will eventually receive those drugs or other medical treatments, but the manufacturing capabilities and all of the R&D, the billions of dollars that goes into the R&D will be spent in China and will be invested in China and not in the United States, benefiting China's economy, not ours. And so this is an area of real concern we are driving innovation. We're offshoring innovation away from the United States to other countries where they provide for reliable and effective patent rights in new inventions.
Yeah, to hit on that point as well and go a little bit more of the 30,000 foot view of the technological and innovative policies there in China, they're looking at moving forward with regards to 5G. Of course, the U.S. is as well, but where I'm getting at is that potentially, and I think that there have been some senators that have brought this to the attention of the administration, the Trump administration, in that maybe we're losing out on developing the 5G standard settings, in that China is leading the way, and that we might, if they are the ones to be able to set the policy, then we would have to basically be following in their footsteps, and they would have control of how everything interacts, how the communication protocols go back and forth. And, so it looks like China is taking a step forward with regards to comparatively to the United States on the innovation and technological policy parts of their standard settings?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I've been primarily focusing on kind of biopharmaceutical innovation, given our current context of the pandemic. But, you know, high-tech innovation is just as important, you know, so whether you're talking about 5G or the Internet of Things or AI, I mean, these are innovations that are cutting edge and should be secured by the U.S. patent system and have been historically. And hopefully will continue to be going forward if we change our innovation policy and our patent laws back to what they were originally. 5G, though, is an area where there's a lot of confusion about what's happened and what's happening. I mean, the primary innovations in 5G are not occurring in China. There's some claims that to the contrary, and that's because China is engaging in some strategic gaming of their patent system at the moment, trying to make it appear like they're more innovative in this area, because this serves their kind of geopolitical goals. China right now is very concerned about, as you described, the national security implications of having Chinese infrastructure, you know, built in the United States and our telecommunication system, whether it's 5G or 4G, because there are serious national security concerns there, right? Because China is an authoritarian country, and so you don't really have private companies there. So Huawei is nominally a private company, but to think that Huawei does not march to the orders of the Chinese government would be a mistake, a serious mistake. And so if Huawei is building infrastructure in the United States, then that would raise serious national security concerns if it's our telecommunications infrastructure that's used by, our banks and our military. And cooks into, and ultimately 5G will be part of even our, you know, electrical infrastructure and our utility systems and everything of this sort. Now, so China is trying to make it appear like they're more innovative in that space, but they're not. I mean, 5G is largely the creation of a U.S. company, Qualcomm, and that, you know, and high tech space that really mirrors the similar types of economic business model dynamics that I described at the biopharma industry. And the reason why I'm saying that is because a lot of people think otherwise, because they think, when they think high tech, they think of like your apps on your phone, like Flappy Bird or Angry Birds and things like that. Yeah, I mean, that doesn't involve a lot of investment. But 5G actually was an incredible innovation, just as much as, you know, all of the Gs were, the generation, in the sense of G's generation, in terms of digital transmission capabilities that make our smartphones smart. It involved about 10 years of R&D work. They had to overcome massive technological problems with micromillimeter waves transmissions, and then figure out how to deploy this technology in a commercially feasible way in the marketplace. And it was ultimately the byproduct of incredible American ingenuity at Qualcomm and long-term investment of hundreds of millions, if not ultimately billions of dollars over many, many years. And that is true of most foundational technologies in the high-tech space, whether you're talking about operating systems, whether you're talking about email clients, whether you're talking about, you know, encryption systems that are used. I mean, these cost, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to create and deploy in the marketplace. And this is why the high-tech industry relies on patent protections and other types of IP protections like copyrights and trademarks just as much as the biopharmaceutical industry does. So it's kind of, there's a myth that you don't need patents in high tech, and that's actually not true. And as I mentioned, China is kind of engaging in some strategic behavior trying to game the people look to usually for roughly measuring patents or innovation, which is patent counts, which is not a really good way to do that. But you know, they're trying to say, well, we have all these patents in 5G. Well, they really don't. They have lots of low quality patents or patents that actually are not foundational and essential to the technologies that comprise 5G. I mean, these patents are primarily held by, you know, Qualcomm, InterDigital, and then some European companies, Nokia and Ericsson. and a few others, they're not primarily the byproduct of Huawei, but China wants to make it appear like they are, because then they can say to the US, well, you can't kick us out because of the US on national security grounds, because without us, you can't have 5G, which is not true. And they can all, and it also positions them vis-a-vis the developing world, because they have what's known as the Digital Silk Road Initiative. China is building, is paying for and building massive amounts of infrastructure in the developing world, both physical infrastructure, roads and utility systems, and digital infrastructures, putting in 5G and whatnot. And it gains a lot of prestige and ability to say to developing countries, let us build your infrastructure, if they can also say, because we're the ones that innovated it. You want us to do it. You don't want the US companies to do it. They're just copying us. You want the real thing. And you can see why China cares about these issues, right? As I mentioned, for these geopolitical reasons, but innovation, being an innovative country with an innovation economy that is cutting edge, is vital to your long-term economic viability as a country, to having being a flourishing country and a flourishing society and having a growing economy. And it's vital vis-a-vis the rest of the world. It positions you as a global leader, as the United States has been positioned, not just because we've had a military, but because we've had the most vibrant economy of the past 200 years of any other country. And people forget this. I mean, when we broke from England in 1776, we were almost entirely an agrarian country. And then when we won the Revolutionary War in 1783, we were massively in debt, economy in shatters because of the very long war. And many people around the world, including England, were expecting that we would come back to the crown, begging to be, readmitted back into the Commonwealth, like an upstart little teenager who has learned their lesson about, that they... You really thought you could do things on your own. You 13 colonies, you were mistaken. And 60 years later, or about 60 or 70 years later, at the Crystal Palace Exposition of 1851, the very first World's Fair, we were marveling the world with our technological innovations. We were showing the world. We had invented sewing machines and vulcanized rubber and the telegraph and the repeating firearm and the mechanized reaper and so on and so on. And people were blown away by this. And they were like, oh my God, well, what's the cause of this? And they realized that part of it was our patent system. These were all patented innovations. And in fact, a lot of countries adopted our patent system after that, because they thought, wow, there's something important here, because it turned this broke, indebted, primarily agrarian country into a world leading country with innovations and industry and a growing economy and a flourishing society. And this is why China is trying to do this as well in this space. And they are creating a patent system to do in the future. So what you've described with 5G is not necessarily true with 5G, but when you're talking about what will come next, what we call it, whether it's 6G or 7G or something, the next generation of technologies, China is positioning itself to be the creator of those technologies. If we don't change our innovation policy right now, that is hampering companies like InterDigital and Qualcomm and others from making the investments necessary to create these technologies.
And that's an excellent segue into where I wanted to go with regards to U.S. patent policy. We have discussed a little bit about the Supreme Court decisions, American Invents Act, and everything that has happened with regards to the patent system within the last decade. Tell me how we got to where we are, and what I mean by that is, how did we become, I guess, arguably on the downward trajectory? And it really depends upon which way you're looking at it, because there are some out there that believe that the patents have been hampering U.S. patent policy, or have technological or innovation policy, and not really have moved us forward. And therefore, we have to take another critical look back at U.S. patents, how they're being issued, how they're being reviewed, and then also giving a second set of eyes through inter-parties review. How did we get here to where the current state of the U.S. patent policy?
Yeah, it's another really great question. And it's, again, you know, one has to be careful about being, you know, unduly reductionist about these things and saying there's one answer, there's a single answer, and the answer is 42. It's a complex story that where a lot of different forces and different actors kind of came into play and came together on certain issues at the same time at various times. So we had explosive growth in our high tech sector of our economy in the past 30 or 40 years, driven by, you know, the extension of copyright protection to software in 1980 and patent protections on hardware from the very beginning, but then to software starting in the 1980s and 1990s, very solid protections, and then of course you had the evolution of the internet, and the evolution of a new type of business model, the internet service provider business model, which is not a new business model per se, because that's just they're intermediaries, they're pass-throughs. We interact with intermediaries all the time, economic intermediaries in our activities, right? You don't buy a car directly from Toyota, you buy it from a dealership. The dealership doesn't make the Toyota car, the dealership's not Toyota. They're an economic mediary that facilitate an exchange between you and Toyota, or you and Ford. You don't directly buy stock from General Electric, you or Google or Microsoft or Amazon, you buy it through a stockbroker. You don't buy gasoline directly from Exxon, you go to a gas station owned by someone else who works through a commercial arrangement with Exxon, and so on and so on. And we have the development of intermediaries on the internet now, Google and Amazon and Facebook and almost all of social media, where they don't produce products and services themselves. They are pass-through entities for other people's content and technologies. And these companies have become extremely wealthy and extremely successful given their innovations on the internet, beginning in the 1990s. I remember, I'm old enough, and I'm sure you are too, Tyson, where we remember where Amazon used to sell just books back in the 1990s. And Google was just a search engine. they didn't have a phone operating system, and they weren't trying, they didn't have a spin-off company creating driverless cars and so on and so on. For companies that are intermediaries, right, especially in the context of the internet, where they are trying to reach as many people as possible, anything that blocks or impedes their ability to have kind of as much free flow of technology and information as possible, you know, from their perspective is a blockade to their business model. They succeed. And they are successful insofar as much information is flowing through their networks as possible. That's how they make their money. And Google through advertising, which is just dependent upon as many people using their service, and so on and so on. And so unsurprisingly, these are business models that are not predicated upon intellectual property rights, or at least on patents and copyrights. They do rely very heavily on trademark. So it's not true that they're anti-IP. They just rely on other types of IP because they have a different type of business model with a different type of value that they're offering to consumers that's secured by other types of IP rights. But they view the kind of the more substantive protections provided by both patents and copyrights as blockades to their success. And they adopted what I think is a very short-term perspective on this, which is therefore we should eliminate these blockades. We should eliminate this because we will be more successful as a search engine. We will be more successful as an intermediary if more people can use our service by accessing more and more information out there. And so they've been lobbying very extensively, spending hundreds of millions of dollars. I think the official estimate of the amount of money spent on the AIA that was enacted into law was over $1 billion. And there was a massive push for additional follow-on legislation after that for about 5 or 6 years that went by the tendentious name of the Innovation Act. Back of the envelope calculations are that, you know, again, up towards over billions of dollars was spent lobbying for this legislation by companies like Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. They go by the acronym now, Fang in DC policy debates. And you know, as I mentioned, you know, it's a very short-term perspective that they unfortunately have, because their business models could evolve and change in the future, and they may end up producing products and services where they need to rely on patents and copyrights at some point in time. And they're shooting themselves in the foot if they undermine these IP protections now. But at the same time, you know, it's also very short-sighted of them to want to undermine and eliminate intellectual property protections and patents and copyrights, because you know, the reality is that, you know, our economy is actually not driven by intermediaries. Our economy is not driven by the ability to use Google or Facebook or social media generally. Our economy is driven by foundational innovations in technology like 5G and operating systems and tech security systems. Our economy is driven by biopharmaceutical innovations and biotech. Our economy is driven by massive amounts of innovative and creative work product that is produced. And if you eliminate those protections, you eliminate the primary drivers of what is truly our innovation economy. They became a fierce and very wealthy and powerful lobbying force. And we know that they did, because they were the ones that helped create this narrative, this policy narrative that goes by the rubric patent troll. That, you know, they've been saying, oh, all of these bad, so-called bad patents and these bad actors are attacking us and are undermining us and things of the sort, and they're preventing us from being innovative because we're having to spend money on all these lawyers. Well, the fact of the matter is that the amount of money that they're actually spending to defend themselves in these cases is insignificant. You know, Google probably spends more money on coffee every day for all of its employees than it does in addressing a nuisance lawsuit. And the data supports that. They actually are not overwhelmed with nuisance lawsuits. And of course, are there some bad actors? Yes, of course there's some bad actors. Bad actors in every legal system. There's bad actors in commercial law, and there's bad actors in bankruptcy, and there's bad actors in our regular real property law. But there are existing legal doctrines that address those. You don't need to undermine and weaken property rights, or you shouldn't undermine or weaken contract rights, or you shouldn't undermine the ability of the bankruptcy system to facilitate, you know, the distribution of assets from bankrupt companies and individuals. You shouldn't weaken those systems simply because there are bad actors. There are existing legal rules and doctrines, both in patent law and more generally in our legal system, to address this. You know, so everyone heard of there's the patent troll who's, you know, suing mom and pop grocery stores and coffee shops because they claim a patent on, you know, Wi-Fi technology. This is MPHJ. They were a bad actor. They were engaging in abusive behavior, deceptive practices, and they were sanctioned by the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission didn't need a new law or a new authorization to do this. They had existing legal precedent and legal authorization to go after people who are engaging in deceptive and abusive business practices, like sending deceptive and abusive demand letters to people saying that they're infringing a patent that either doesn't even exist or is invalid. So this patent troll narrative, you know, just has swamped the whole innovation discussion in DC, you know, and it's really unfortunate. First of all, the term is just it's an epithet. It's just a policy epithet. It's been used to attack universities. It's been used to attack actual inventors. It's been used to attack basically anyone who is not a manufacturer. But, you know, great innovators in this country's history were not manufacturers. You know, Thomas Edison did not manufacture his inventions. He licensed them. Charles Goodyear, when he invented vulcanized rubber, did not manufacture rubber. Goodyear Tire Rubber Company has nothing to do with Charles Goodyear. It was formed about 40 years after he died, in fact. It was just named after him because he was so famous for having invented the process for having commercializable, usable rubber. In fact, it precipitated a trademark lawsuit with his family over the use of the name. Elias Howe, you know, inventor of the lock stitch technology used in sewing machines, didn't run a Howe sewing machine company. He licensed his technologies. And so, I mean, you know, we have a term in our policy debates that would actually require us to condemn as illegitimate. Thomas Edison and Charles Goodyear and Elias Howe and other great innovators and that have driven the U.S. innovation economy. I mean, and it's used today to condemn inventors for the same reason that, you know, they don't invent, they don't manufacture, they're licensing their technologies to other people. Or is used to attack universities. You know, so Carnegie Mellon, the University of Wisconsin, they've been accused of, when they've sued people for patent infringement of the patents created by their professors, that you're being a patent troll because you don't manufacture your product or service. This should cause people to step back and say, is this a legitimate term? Because this term has so, as I mentioned, kind of come to dominate the patent policy discussions in DC. It's what's driven the Supreme Court in many ways. It's what's driven the regulatory agencies and it's driven Congress to continually degrade our patent system and copyright system as well. And to undermine these kind of reliable and effective rights that have, you know, been the foundation for creators and innovators in this country for many, many, many decades, the past two centuries to, make our modern life possible. This is not something that just kind of popped out of anywhere.
It's such an interesting story that, or what you just brought up, because it takes me back. There was a legislation that was bouncing around after the American Invents Act, and I believe it was in response to MPHJ. And I ended up having a discussion with a local congressperson, called me up and wanted to kind of go through it because they weren't sure of exactly what was in this or how patent policy worked or anything like that. So they kind of needed a deep dive. So after discussing the pros and cons of everything that's going on and discussing about the cease and desist, this particular congressperson made the comment, well, it was basically along the lines of, well, we have this strong narrative. I have, essentially some big donors in the grocery store space, and they don't want to be getting hit up with these basically end user or whatever type lawsuits that were going around at the time. And I can't remember if it was particularly the Wi-Fi case or whatnot, but at the same time, you're having this narrative controlled by with regards to the podcast, mm-hmm. podcasting patent. And so it was around that same time frame. And so basically I was just left aghast at, even though we explained everything about why the patent policy or why patent policy needs to be updated, strengthened, whatnot, it all went back to, well, I have some donors here that really would like to not be getting hit with lawsuits, patent lawsuits. And so thus, I have to kind of move in this way with regards to the cease and desist letter legislation.
Yeah.
It's controlling the narrative. And
right.
It's something that, and patent law is an obscure piece of law that not a lot of people are aware of. And so when you can control the narrative of how things are potentially bad, you find yourself having to fight, first of all, the narrative, and then explaining why it's so important. And then you have, they've been able to control with the patent troll or the patent assertion narrative. And it's just, a difficult hill to climb.
Yeah. There's a old saying in Washington, D.C. is if you're explaining, you're losing. And it's true, right? I mean, they've had the advocates for patent innovation on the defensive. They're setting the very terms of the debate. So if you're going into a discussion with someone and you're having to explain why something is not a problem, you're on defense already. You're losing, and that has certainly been the case for the past 10 or 15 years, in the patent policy debates. And they've been very effective at it. as I mentioned, the FANG coalition has been very effective. They brought in, the grocery stores and other, and restaurants and other one people to say, we're being sued by these people. Main Street USA is being, held up by, these quote patent trolls, unquote. For the first point to kind of always keep in mind, right, is first of all, none of this is new. In fact, that's one of the allegations, is this is all new. So we have to change the patent system because this is new. We never had this experience before, so we need to change the patent system to accommodate this new experience. Even Justice Kennedy repeated this narrative that this is all new in the eBay decision in a concurring opinion in that case, which was just false. End-user lawsuits, what are called end-user lawsuits, suing, the people, the consumer who purchases and uses a technology, and debates about end user lawsuits and about whether they're legitimate or not go back to the 19th century. In fact, there was a massive litigation campaign by a patent licensing company. One of the actual licensees was Charles Goodyear. This is the Vulcanite Dental Rubber Company, because rubber was being deployed in dental implants as one of the many areas in our life that have been vastly improved by this innovation. And this was a patent licensing company that made its money by basically suing dentists and negotiating licenses with them. And they would send pretty women to dentist's office and have the pretty women kind of instigate the dentist to offer a an unauthorized rubber implant as a for a tooth problem, and then they would later sue the dentist, and hundreds of dentists were sued by this Vulcanite Dental Rubber Company in this massive litigation campaign that only came to an end when one of the dentists, who was very distraught by this, shot and killed the president and lawyer of the Vulcanite Dental Rubber Company. So it's a good thing we don't actually resolve our patent disputes that way, as they did in the 19th century. But, farmers were sued for unauthorized uses of barbed wire in the late 19th century, and this created a massive lobbying campaign to eliminate patent rights by farmers who were saying, the patent owners are holding up our innovation, driving the innovation in this country and with cattle and farming and things of the sort. Railroads also engage in a massive lobbying campaign in the late 19th century as well, saying we're being sued by all these patent owners. It's illegitimate, these bad patents. So first of all, this is not new, but these debates and these issues and the doctrines that existed at that time that addressed any of the actual bad actors that may have existed. I don't know how many were around that were existed, but is the way I do now, for instance, about MPHA. But I'm sure there were some addressed them, and the patent system kind of continued to be applied with reliable and effective of rights. And we should be doing the same today. But it's also, I think there's a legitimate point to be made that like a restaurant or a grocery store complaining about, a patent lawsuit, sure, listen to that. But, if you're talking about fundamentally changing the legal infrastructure that drives our innovation economy, the restaurant or the grocery store, they don't have a perspective on that. And that is not something that they are a stakeholder in. And they should be talking to and hearing from actual stakeholders in the patent system, people whose business models depend upon patents, right? So if they're talking about making it harder to sue, harder to receive patents, harder to license patents, they should be hearing from the people who actually license their patents and have to sue people for infringing their patents, and people who make the billions of dollars of investments in creating the technologies that are protected by patents. And when those people say, this is a problem, you're killing our business model, you're killing our ability to innovate, then they should pay attention. And in fact, that's ultimately what happened. The legislation you're talking about in part did not get enacted because universities and venture capitalists and associations representing individual inventors and other entities stepped forward and said, we will be undermined and if not completely eviscerated in our capability to fund and produce new innovative products and services if you pass this type of legislation. And thankfully, they succeeded, but nonetheless, the narrative continues and it prevents reform. We've been unable to reform the patent system and, you know, overrule these bad Supreme Court decisions that you mentioned earlier, Mayo and Myriad, on patent eligibility doctrine and overruling eBay and things of this sort. Because every time you talk about this, FANG pops back up and says, ooh, patent trolls, this will bring back patent trolls. And that just, that brings everything to a dead stop in positive, productive discussions in the patent policy debates in DC.
Yeah, and the one thing that I look back and I take actually, it's funny, in the past 2 weeks, I've run across it, especially now that home with all the quarantine. On two different occasions, I look and I see, and it was my wife today that actually purchased a bunch of balloons packet. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing because I go back and anytime I see it, and I mentioned it in the last 2 weeks because I saw someone else had purchased a bunch of balloons, a neighbor of mine. And so the first thing that comes to my mind, of course, is Josh Malone and how he legitimately went through the patent system and the trials and tribulations that he has had on a actual unique product that it's just an amazing story, but it's something that he's had to fight with and fight. He basically got, well, he had the patent on what's now a bunch of balloons and has had to go through just myriad trials and post-grant reviews and the trouble that one has to go through in order to try and protect his property rights or his patents, mm-hmm. and his innovations. And so it's just amazing. But anytime I run across a bunch of balloons, the first thing that pops up is, well, how innovative they are, because how many balloons you can blow up in such a short amount of time. But where the current situation of the patent, U.S. patent policy is now, and how difficult it is to enforce one's patent rights.
Yeah, that's a great point and a great example. I mean, Josh has actually written about this very publicly, that, you know, he spent upwards of $18 million of his own money defending his rights and his patent against willful, deliberate, unapologetic infringers. It was, you know, the company as seen on TV company that, you know, purchased and shipped one of his products over to China. Well, to go back to the China story from earlier, that then started to make an infringing product and have it sold in the United States. And, you know, and the As Seen on TV company is a very large and wealthy company. And he was just he was just some guy who invented this, took out a bunch of money from his savings account, took time off from work. And he's like, Josh is this kind of classic American success story. I know him and his story very well. And I've spoken at conferences with him. And, and of course, his product was a massive success. I've used it too. In fact, that was one of the things I was really excited when I met him, because when I first met him, I said, oh, you created this amazing product that saved me hours of my life with all of my kids' birthday parties and summer celebrations. In filling up 100 balloons and under water balloons in under a minute. It's again another way that kind of you don't realize all of the even small ways that innovative technologies and patents underlie everything from the very large kind of incredible things that we think of, our smartphones and our rocket ship technologies and things of that sort, and our new drugs, all the way down to, like I said, our coffee machines and our automobiles, our refrigerators, and a bunch of balloons. And all of these add up to, you know, flourishing lives, saving us time, saving us labor, saving us effort, saving us money. And that's what makes it possible for us to grow and succeed. He had, when he sued for his patent infringement because they refused to pay him a license, you know, they brought multiple petitions against him, against the Patent Trial and Appeal Board at the USPTO, the administrative tribunal whose sole job is to cancel and eliminate issued patents. And they do it so well, they've been referred to as a death squad of patents, with at times upwards of anywhere from 70 to 90% cancellation rates, or what are referred to sometimes in patent policy debates as kill rates, because they're so high. And they're high not because these are questionable patents. These are high because the system is stacked against the inventor, like against the patent owner, with, you know, very low evidentiary standards. There's no due process. They engage in what's called panel stacking, where they keep adding new administrative judges to the panels to reach decisions that they believe ought to be reached, and so on and so on. It's really a par excellence example of kind of what happens when you have an agency that is unrestricted in both process and substance, and what can happen when you create that, which is it runs riot over the procedural and substantive rights of U.S. citizens. He has made the point that, you know, I was very successful with my Bunch of Blooms product, incredibly successful. In fact, he was one of the very first Kickstarter campaigns, I think, to which he raised some huge amount of money. He said, how many inventors, how many individuals in their garages like me have $18 million sitting in the bank ready to spend to defend their innovation, their legitimate innovation, against, you know, willful, deliberate, unapologetic infringers who are just copying? And, you know, and this is a story you hear again and again and again. Sonos recently sued Google, right? And it's the mirror story of Josh Malone, right? That we created this innovative, you know, wireless, you know, speaker technology, incredibly innovative. They're cutting edge. This is why we have wireless speakers today, for all intents and purposes. And they had licensing negotiations and a licensing arrangement for a while. And then Google just at one point said, well, we're just going to take your technology and make our own. And Sonos has been forced to sue them. And this is a story that's often been told about Google and many other companies. It's the story of Apple v. Samsung. Apple went to Samsung and asked for a license, for Samsung to pay to license, pay a royalty, $30 a phone, which is what other phone companies were paying Apple at the time as well. This came out during the litigation because, you know, Steve Jobs is going around, you know, saying, I'm going thermonuclear war on them. You know, they stole my technology. But at the same time, you know, Apple is a company, has a fiduciary obligation to its shareholders to maximize its value. So they first went to Samsung and said, well, you've taken our technology, you're using it without authorization, so pay us for a license. We'll give you permission. And Samsung said, go pound sand. We're not paying you, we're Samsung. Samsung, for people to know, is they're your massive conglomerate in South Korea. They make you know, shipping container ships and airplane engines and all sorts of things, and smartphones. And so what was Apple supposed to do but to sue them? Because you had no other option at that point in time. You know, people often talk about how, patent litigation is bad. But, you know, if you think about it, litigation is the only thing you have left when someone is using your property, using what is rightfully yours without your permission, and they refuse to use it on your terms, whether to even pay you for that use. Imagine someone coming into your home and taking over one of your bedrooms and saying, I'm just going to be here. And I'm not going to pay you even rent. I'm just going to sleep in your spare bedroom. You know, no one would think twice that you would legitimately sue them for trespass and ask for an injunction to have them kicked out of your home. You know, and patent owners are simply just doing the exact same thing when a large company or even or any other company starts using without permission their technology. And that's exactly what patents do. Patents are, in a certain sense, the great leveler. Property rights are a great leveler. They give that individual, the startup company or the lone inventor like Josh Malone, they give them that ability to go up against the well-established massive conglomerate and disrupt them, because they have that protection. They have that domain of liberty around their innovation, their property interest, that they can define the terms of how they use it. And they do. And that's what drives the cycle of innovation. And that's what drives and grows our economy. And that's made possible by property rights in all things, whether farms as well as patents.
Yeah, except that arguably right now patent owners don't have the ability with the injunctive relief up until about 2006.
Yep. Yeah. So that comes back to, we've lost that. And if we need to get our country back on track, back on its historical innovation policy track, which has been was a very successful track record, for 200 years, you know, we displaced England. You know, the Industrial Revolution started in England in the 18th century. We displaced them in the 19th century. Again, you know, little startup, you know, nascent little United States of America, displaced them. in the 19th century. And we then didn't displace anyone in the 20th century. We led the world with the computer revolution, with the biotech revolution, with the pharmaceutical revolution, and so on and so on, the mobile revolution. And this was on the foundation of reliable and effective patents, reliable and effective property rights and innovations. And so what, you know, we need to get back to that. And so we need to restore the ability of patent owners to be able to stop willful, deliberate trespasses of their rights. You know, return back to the rule that property owners can say no to someone who wished to come onto their property or use their property without permission or on terms or disregard the terms being offered to them. So we need to restore in the law what's known as injunctive relief for patent owners. We need to restore the ability of patent owners to license freely in the marketplace again. So under Supreme Court decisions known as Quanta Computing and then later Lexmark, you know, the Supreme Court has eviscerated the ability of patent owners to engage in the type of innovative commercial development with licensing, with commercial arrangements that patent owners traditionally have been able to engage in. You know, patent owners and other IP owners innovated the franchise business model, which is an IP licensing business model. So Samuel Morse embraced this, and other sewing machine innovators embraced this, and Alexander Graham Bell embraced this as a business model that facilitated the fast, easy, efficient deployment of these new technologies into the marketplace. And so it's not just McDonald's and Chick-fil-A. It's basic foundational technologies. That needs to be restored. The Patent Trial and Appeal Board needs to be in my ideal world, I would eradicate it. and I'm on record for that. I filed an amicus brief in this court case you mentioned earlier, known as Oil States, where I said PTAB is unconstitutional. But it's where the Supreme Court said, well, PTAB's going to stay here because these are regulatory entitlements. These are monopoly grants, so they can be adjudicated by a regulatory agency like the PTAB. But so if we're going to have the PTAB, then the PTAB needs to be brought under the same rules of due process and protection of the substantive rights of all individuals appearing before the U.S. court that would normally be protected by them. And we need to restore the protections for classic innovations. We need to, abrogate the Supreme Court decisions in patent eligibility doctrine and return the U.S. back to protecting those cutting-edge innovations right now in biotech, in high-tech, and soon AI, Internet of Things, who knows what's going to come out of 5G in the same way that 4G was a platform, incredible platform for innovations that no one predicted. No one could have predicted Uber and Airbnb and all the things that were made possible by 4G with expanded bandwidth. It's, the next wave of innovators will figure out new ways to use this platform technology. And so we need to have those foundational technologies protected again as well.
Yeah, no. And before we finish up with the potential issues of COVID in the COVID-19 era, I just wanted to kind of illustrate for our listeners how important I think injunctive relief is. Because, for example, if you think of what's the incentive for the potential infringer. So if you had a plot of land and big company comes up and starts using that land and you have to go to litigation, well, right now, if you think about it within patent policy, you wouldn't be able to get injunctive relief against them infringing on your land, and therefore they can continue developing or whatever and before the court case has finished. And so the importance here is to be able to incentivize to get those companies to the table for the patent owners. And I think that that's one of the things that Adam is talking about here and why injunctive relief is so important, in that since 2006, it's been very difficult, if not impossible, for a patent owner to get injunctive relief against a product and prevent them from using, making, or selling that until the court case has concluded. Would that be a fair overview of it?
Well, it's not just until the court, you're not getting the injunction.
Correct.
Statistical studies are showing that you're not getting injunction. So what's happening is that patent owners are being forced into what lawyers refer to in a rarefied form as rate regulation. Patent lawyers call compulsory licensing. And everyone else and just any person would just say government setting of prices and rates, which is the judge saying, well, I'm denying you an injunction. And I'm going to award you, me, a judge who doesn't know anything about the commercial practice or the industry or anything. I'm going to figure out what I think is the reasonable royalty rate that you should be paid through a license. And this is a real problem. Yeah. Because you hit on it. I think you hit on it very well. A lot of people think of injunctions and again, the narrative about injunctions is this, oh, it shuts down. It stops. It prevents people from innovating. Well, that's not true. That's not the function of injunctions. Yes, for some people it is. For some people, for a small segment of the world, an injunction is to stop. But the injunction is not the mechanism for commercial actors of stopping. The injunction is the backstop, which is what makes possible the commercial exchange in the free market in the first place. If you can't have the ability at the end of the day to say, no, you have to use my property on my terms, then there's no reason or incentive for anyone to engage in free market exchanges. They'll just take the property. They'll just take the goods. It's the ability of having the control over the exclusive use of something, which is your ability to say to someone, if you want to use this is the value of it. And to have that negotiation in the marketplace, as I mentioned, that's what Apple tried to do with Samsung. And so this is what landlords do with tenants. I mentioned earlier, the squatter in your spare bedroom, but if you think of it, there's a business model for people who actually sell interests in their real estate, in their businesses that they own, in the buildings. They're called landlords, and they sell those interests to people. But they have to have the backstop, the ability to say no in order to set the rate is for the rent. And so on and so on. And if you don't have the ability to say no, you don't have the ability to have a free market negotiation. I mean, this is kind of the foundation of economics, from the get-go. Adam Smith's great insight in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, right, is that it's specialization and division of labor, which is what drives economic growth. But what makes specialization and division of labor possible? Well, my ability to say to you, well, you make one component and I'll make another component. Adam Smith's example was a pin factory. The person who digs the ore out of the ground is not the same person who takes the ore to the factory, is not the same person who actually then shapes the ore into a pin, is not the same person who then takes the pin to the marketplace to sell the pin. And the same thing occurs in our hard tech space. The person who designs one chip in your phone is not the person who actually makes the phone, it's not the person who makes the glass, it's not the person who makes your email app, works on your phone, and so on and so on. But all of those people are only able to work with each other and reach the kind of the commercial arrangements and negotiations and the license deals and the commercial contracts they're able to make on the basis of saying, I get to decide what the value is of my product in the marketplace and offer that. And you get to decide if that's something that you want to have an exchange with me with. If you don't have the ability to say no, if they could just take the chip or take the glass, then you don't have complex supply chains, you don't have complex value chains, you don't have division of labor, specialization, and you don't have a growing innovation economy.
All right. Well, to finish up, because I think that we've hit on a lot of important topics here, and I think all of we have touched on, first of all, how do we make the patent system great again? And then kind of package that with where we are in the COVID-19 era. We've talked about diagnostics, patent eligibility issues, but if there was something to kind of summarize in your ideas, what would it be to make our patent system great again and get us up and running like we are, like China is?
Well, as I said, just quickly summarize, because I'm very loquacious as an academic, I apologize for that, we should reestablish, reliable and effective property rights protections for innovators in our country. Patents don't just incentivize someone to invent. They are the bridge by being property rights in facilitating the commercialization of that invention, turning that invention into innovation, into something that is usable and purchasable by consumers in the marketplace. This is a key feature historically of what made U.S. have a unique patent system as created by Congress and its authorization in the Constitution to do so. And it's been a key driver of our innovation economy, and it's what we've lost in the past 10 to 15 years, and it's what we need to reestablish if we're going to continue to grow and continue to produce not just new technologies, but produce the new incredible medical tests and drugs and ultimately vaccines that will treat not just COVID-19, but the next pandemic and ongoing maladies like cancer and hepatitis and diabetes.
We need to incentivize venture capitalists to start pouring money back into the United States. I've heard from so many of how difficult it is because they want to have some type of, I'll call it tangible, but it's actually intangible, but some type of rights that they could latch onto in order to exchange this money to the biotech companies to create these new therapeutics, because these biotech companies don't have the money. They need to go out and raise it. And venture capitalists, in exchange for that, would like to have some type of way to protect their investment. And of course, property right or patent rights, excuse me, were those that had traditionally been utilized by the venture capitalists in order to raise the money and give the money to the biotech companies for vaccines, therapeutics. And so it's truly very important. And unfortunately, what we see out of the Senate and the Congress sometimes is speaking about that everyone needs the stakeholders to get together. You need to have the biotech come together with the technology lobbyists in order to come up with the law. In my opinion, Congress or Senate, you know, should just be doing the right thing. But of course, you know, we have lobbyists and so forth. But it's one of the bad, unfortunate pieces that we have is that we have senators that are on the IP subcommittee saying, well, it has to be left up to the stakeholders to develop what the law is. Well, unfortunately, it actually is their job, not the lobbyist's job. But that's kind of my own take there. Mm-hmm. So, well, hey, I truly appreciate it. This has been so insightful. I truly appreciate your time. And hopefully the listeners have gotten a little bit more understanding of the patent system, what we need to do to make the patent system great again and to move it forward. So I truly appreciate your time, Adam.
Well, thank you, Tyson. I had a great time with you. You really asked me wonderful questions, and really it was a fun discussion. Thank you.
Well, that concludes this episode of Alternating Current. I want to again extend my thanks to Adam Mossoff for his truly insightful discussion into the current state of U.S. patent policy. If you want to be notified when the next episodes drop, please hit that subscribe button. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay safe.